Kia ora and welcome to Co-op Leader Conversations. I'm Sia Warlick, CEO of Cooperative Business New Zealand. Now, when I attended and spoke at a BCCM summit in Adelaide earlier this year, one topic that came up was housing cooperatives. Across Australia, they're giving people secure, affordable homes and building community ownership at a scale that we don't see yet in New Zealand. Here at home, we still typically think in 2 tenures, own or rent. And that leaves a lot of people out. So today we're asking, what might we be missing out on by not supporting co-op housing as a mainstream option? And who better to help us explore that than Liz Thomas, Managing Director of Common Equity Housing Limited and Chair of the Australian Cooperative Housing Alliance. Welcome, Liz.
Well, good morning.
Thank you so much for taking part. And as I said, here in New Zealand, look, we still really only see two housing options, own or rent. There's not really a clear legal framework or finance pathway for co-op housing. So banks treat co-ops as more of a commercial risk, typically, and government programs overlook them. Land here in New Zealand is relatively expensive, and our policy settings do keep shifting. And culturally, here in New Zealand, we definitely prize individual ownership over shared solutions when it comes to the home. But affordability is worsening, and there are tens of thousands on the public housing register. So we might be missing out on a proven model that really helps build community as well as homes. But it does feel like we're on the cusp of change. In the New Zealand Housing Survey that was released in October 2025, New Zealanders are signalling clear demand for more diverse housing choices that cater to different life stages, different financial situations, and different cultural needs. So, in this new generation of Kiwis, the desire for flexibility is now coming through as a major factor in housing demand being expressed by the housing survey respondents, with many feeling that the current choices aren't always in the right places or the right type of houses to suit their needs. So, Liz, for listeners that are new to the idea, what is Common Equity Housing Limited and how do your member co-ops fit in?
So, Common Equity Housing is a federated co-op model. Essentially, CEHL is a property developer and a property manager, and we manage the significant part of our portfolio, which is around 2,200 properties across Victoria. We manage that primarily through business-to-business partnerships with independent rental housing co-ops. So that's within a nutshell. That's how this model works. And if I can just refer to your earlier point, Sire, in relation to what has been a relatively recent change in how we view housing in Australia and New Zealand. I think for the first time, we are having to contemplate a future where home ownership is not available to everyone. And that the private rental housing market isn't where you wait while you save a home deposit to move on to home ownership.
Yeah,
In
sure.
Australia, one third of our population are now facing being renters for life.
Wow.
And we really do have to provide an opportunity for them other than the vagaries of the private rental market. And I think that's where there is a growing interest in rental housing cooperatives and how they might offer permanent, affordable rental housing, as a genuine part of a housing paradigm.
That's really interesting. And I think there could be a perception here in New Zealand that a housing co-op is kind of like a commune or can be like a commune. What you've described is a very structured, secure and commercially sound model that feels very, very different to the end of the spectrum that potentially the perceptive is perception is here. So can you tell me about someone who's joining a CEHL co-op, what as a resident, what does that journey look like?
So, well, in the first instance, if I describe the journey of an individual co-op member and how they might form a relationship with a housing co-op, we have a register of interest for people within the community who are interested in joining co-ops and each individual housing co-op. So we have just under 90 co-ops across Victoria. In regional, rural, and metro areas, that's another important fact. So a person would express interest in wanting to join a co-op. They'd then come along to a CHL co-op information evening or session where we would explain to them what it means to live in a co-op. So co-op housing is different to private rental or home ownership. People are actively involved in the management of their housing. So there are responsibilities and accountabilities of being a co-op member, and we go to great lengths to ensure people clearly understand that before they sign up to co-op housing. If someone's been to an information session and they say, "Yes, I'm up for this, I want to be a part of a housing co-op," and you're right, so there was this idea that people co-ops were full of people who in the 70s went from the kibbutz to the co-op. It's simply not like that anymore. In 2022, the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute promulgated a study that the majority of older Australians who cannot afford to own their own home prefer the model of a housing cooperative, so to live within a community. So someone who goes to an information session says, "Yes, I want to live in a co-op. I understand that means," and then they actually go on a wait list until a vacancy arises. The average length of tenure in co-op housing in Victoria is 14 years. So in public housing in Victoria, it's about 2 years in the one property. So the important thing to identify is that co-op housing makes commercial sense in a lot of ways. And one of those ways is your operating overheads are less because the turnover in your property, the churn of your property portfolio, is significantly less. I mean, think of how many people reside in the private rental market for 14 years on average. So it really is about permanent affordable housing. When a person joins the co-op, they are then that's the first step, and by virtue of their membership, they're then offered a tenancy of a co-op property. It's explained to people when they join the co-op that as a co-op member, they will be expected to be actively involved in the co-op community, to attend meetings. Now, some co-ops meet once every 2 months, some meet once every 3 months. And in time, they will also be expected to assume a role within a co-op. And most co-ops have a chair of the co-op board, a secretary, a treasurer. They might have a rent manager, a tenancy manager. Each co-op's its own business, so defines its own roles. But there are generally three or four common roles within every co-op. Once they join the co-op, they're tenancy is with the housing cooperative, not with common equity. That's an important point. And from there on in, you pay your rent on time and you're a good neighbour. And that's how you maintain your, and you're a good neighbour and you're a good member of the co-op. And that's how you maintain your tenancy. The co-op, if you'd like me to go on to explain a little bit how that model
Yeah,
works.
absolutely. I'd love
Yeah.
to. Yeah, thank you.
So CHL effectively head leases properties in perpetuity to the housing cooperative, subject to the housing cooperative meeting responsibilities that are outlined in a company co-op agreement. The co-op collects the rent, so chooses the tenant. CHL does a due diligence of members that are selected, and that's primarily so we guard against nepotism. We ensure that there's no discrimination or human rights violation in the selection of tenancy members. So that's a really important check and balance. So you don't end up with everyone with the surname Smith living in, the one co-op.
Yeah, sure. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, that's an
No, it's a
incredibly important aspect.
really important aspect that you have that check and balance within there. So once that's in place, the co-op collects the rent from the member. They retain 45% of the rent that's collected, and they remit 55% of the rent collected to common equity. The co-op is responsible for the responsive maintenance on the property. So that's, painting, carpet, the general day-to-day maintenance of the property. Common Equity is responsible for the capital maintenance on the property, so building works, construction works, asset works, and also the compliance aspects of the co-op. So that's one of the things that killed a lot of co-ops in Australia in the 70s and 80s. As the compliance frameworks for community housing increased, it became increasingly difficult for co-ops to manage their own compliance and regulatory regime. CHL is ultimately responsible for the regulation and compliance of co-ops. For example, one of the things that's a very hot topic for us at the moment are gas, electric, and safety compliance and smoke alarm compliance testing. By law in Victoria, that needs to happen every 2 years. We need to make sure that those compliance checks are undertaken in relation to our co-ops. So that's effectively how the relationship works. Each co-op is assigned a CHL staff member as their co-op coordinator. So that's their go-to reference point when they've got. They might have challenges or particular problems. Each co-op we encourage to develop an annual business plan, and that's the role of their co-op coordinator that is a CHL staff member. The CHL meets with each co-op board twice a year. Our co-op board directors meet with our CHL board directors. So that's really once the relationship is set, it generally then has a defined structure of how it works and moves through. Each co-op is a shareholder in the company, Common Equity Housing Limited. So when we talk about renter voice, that is a really important way that our co-ops hold CHL accountable. For how we manage the company to provide their housing.
That's fascinating.
I can go on, but I'll stop there. I'll pause for
Well, yeah, I mean that it's so much more structured and clean than I think I'd imagined, the way that you've described it. And I was really interested in your when you described the differences in the tenure, so the 14 years on average in the co-op housing compared to 2 years on average in public housing. And I guess that proportional difference in tenure almost plays out a little bit to the research that we've recently done here in New Zealand, where we've shown that co-ops and mutuals last on average 5 times longer than a company. So when you think about the sort of multiplier there, the enduring nature of the relationship in whatever way, shape, or form it might be in the cooperative and with the cooperative, obviously is playing out as well in cooperative housing.
I think with when you have permanent tenure of a property, your house becomes your home. And I think when you as a person I met when I first started in this job said to me, I can choose the color I paint my walls. I can choose my carpet. If I want a pergola built onto my property, I can go along to a co-op meeting and make my case. So they're dealing with, and on average, our scatter site co-ops, so they're standalone properties, so they're 3 or 4 bedroom properties on individual suburban blocks, are about ideal size is around 20 to 25 properties. It increases if it's a medium or high density apartments like buildings like we have in the metro area. But I think that's a key difference. The other key difference we know through a really important piece of work that was done by the University of Greater Western Sydney is that the cost of running co-op housing is about 15% less than the cost of running traditional community housing models. But where it really delivers in spades is in terms of the health and well-being outcomes for co-op members. So education, employment, training. health and well-being outcomes, not just for the co-op members, but their children, because the children have stability. The children know what school they're going to go to year on year. The children have opportunities to establish community links and friendship networks. It's a really important benefit of co-op housing. It doesn't just deliver housing outcomes, it delivers much, much broader outcomes.
That is a fantastic perspective, and it definitely follows on from the way that somebody described housing co-ops to me when I first joined Cooperative Business New Zealand, was that people that are in that choose to be part of a co-op housing are active participants in their housing outcomes, not passive recipients. So it completely changes the mindset, not only of the individual, but as you say, of the entire family unit, that's in and around the tenure in the co-op.
It's person-centered and community-driven.
Lovely way to describe it.
And I think ultimately, when I participate in discussions about funding and financing about of housing cooperatives, so I keep going back, can we put the person at the center of this discussion? And if you have a person-centered, community-driven approach to delivering housing, that must deliver better outcomes than a bureaucracy-driven process or outcome. And so when you put, as homeowners, people have autonomy and accountability for their own housing. So do they in co-op housing. It's ultimately what people have. And when we look at housing co-ops and what can they deliver in Australia and New Zealand, I think we need to look at, what's happening in Ireland, what's happening in UK, what's happening in Canada. This is happening there. I mean, the Canadians are onto this. They've just announced another $250 million investment in co-op housing. The UK's just announced another £25 million investment in co-op housing. We have to know, we have to have the tenacity to acknowledge our housing model is broken in Australia. That post-war model of everyone should aspire for housing ownership has gone. And it is a, we have to wake up from that dream of home ownership because it's actually a nightmare for a significant amount of people. And to hold that out as aspirational for people who have no chance of succeeding in home ownership, is not a sensible or humane approach to how we manage our community.
That's an excellent point. And talking about the kind of financing side of it, obviously other countries are doing a much better job and have been doing a better job than New Zealand, particularly in Australia, for some time when it comes to co-op housing. So I really want to turn now to sort of the finance part and how housing co-ops get banked and scaled. Obviously here in New Zealand, we've got some work to do to really help our banks understand the co-op housing model. So I'm really curious to understand, when you add new homes, what does the capital sort of stack and process look like?
So the important benefit that common equity housing has is we own our own balance sheet. So we've got a balance sheet of about $1.2 billion with only about 8% debt leveraged against that. So we have a really solid balance sheet. When we look at doing property development, the capital stack is made up of government funding, our funding, and private lending that CHL negotiates.
I
The
see.
key point for funding and finance institutions is you are not lending to ABC Housing Co-op. You are le lending to Common Equity Housing Limited, a registered company with a strong balance sheet, and we assume the responsibility for the debt. That's the benefit of a federated housing co-op model. That's quite different to a group of people who might get together and decide to form an individual housing co-op. I think that's much more problematic, and the banks are necessarily shy of that. We work with our housing co-ops to determine what their development needs are. We have a lot of, because of the length of tenure, we have a lot of our housing co-op members are aging in place. They've got a 3 or 4 bedroom property they've raised their family in, and they now want to downsize. We recently won an Australian Housing Institute award where we took a large block, a Federation house with a lemon tree at the back. We demolished the house, which was had one occupant, so it was the surviving mother in that family home. We relocated her, we demolished the property, and we put 4 2-bedroom units, level access units, on that same block. Eight, sorry. So we got 8 in return for one. So that, but we did that in consultation with the local housing co-ops. They had those 8 units from when we handed over the keys to the housing co-op. So CHL oversaw the funding of the development. We managed the development of it. So we, that's what I say, we're a property developer. When we handed over the keys, the co-op had 8 properties fully tenanted within 72 hours.
Wow, that's incredible. And I
Well,
guess the co-op is collecting and understanding the need of their local community, and that need is flowing through to CEHL in order to develop to meet the
So that
need.
co-op knew it needed some younger members to balance the aging profile. So they actively targeted younger members. A co-op might, for example, know that it needs someone maybe to be the treasurer. So they'll actively seek someone who has bookkeeping or finance backgrounds and experience. The other point that makes the common equity model commercially viable, and that's the point I think you referenced before, this model has great community and social outcomes, but it also makes sound economic sense. CHL doesn't receive any government funding. We compete for capital funding, but our operations are completely self-funding. And one of the things that we bear in mind is that in setting our rents, the rents are affordable because they're set at 25% of household income. More usually, community housing providers charge 30% of household income. We charge 25%, and that's called a sweat equity discount. Because you're actively involved in managing your property, you receive a rental concession. So it's 25% of household income up to the market rent of the property, which
So
is.
that 25% varies depending on who's there, or is it 25% of the average household income in the state, or
No, of the household,
the
each
household that's in
household.
there?
Yep. So
Okay.
we do an annual rent review where we will assess the income of every adult person in your household, and your rent will be set at 25% of the combined household income up to the market rent of the property. So 22% of our renters currently, our co-op members currently pay market rent.
Right.
And the benefit of that, though, so about 75% of our members, co-op members, are women. And that's primarily because women tend to experience more housing insecurity than men. And a lot of women in Australia, I'm not sure of the situation, I imagine it's similar in New Zealand. Women who've had periodic careers and limited access to superannuation in Australia as they retire. So they might, housing stability, they might go back and get a job. But when they reach retirement age, then that's when a lot of people experience significant challenges. So as they retire and their income goes down, so does their rent. That model is flexible.
That's incredible. And when you think about it, so incredibly beneficial. And you can see why people have a 14-year tenure on average when the model is so flexible to flex with them in their own personal situation.
So the chair of our board, she joined her co-op, I think 23 years ago, as a supporting parent of a young son, and she needed to establish a career path as a supporting parent, and so she went back and studied nursing. Now she says, and I share this with her permission, that she would not have been able to return to study had she not been living in a housing cooperative with permanent stable housing for her and her
Yes.
son. She qualified as a nurse. She's now a nurse educator and has been paying market rent on her property for a significant period of time. And that effectively cross-subsidises the rest of the co-op housing programs. So, but as Fiona nears retirement age, she has the certainty of knowing as her income goes down, her rent goes down, and she can stay in the same house, which is just around the corner from where her mother lives in aged care.
I
So,
mean, it must be such an incredible weight off the shoulders of people that are tenants in a housing cooperative to have that certainty.
and they live within a community. You know, it's like in public housing in Australia, we tend to have these congregations of disadvantage. So we'll put public housing in a particular area that is not socially integrated within our co-ops are socially integrated within the whole community. And there is that sense of permanence and security that people have. I often get our co-op members to come and talk at different events with me about, because I can talk about common equity, but they can tell their own story. And they'll talk about, I felt as though I'd won the lottery. I couldn't, and which sounds terrific, but I personally have a real issue that someone has to consider permanent housing as the same as you would as the chance of winning a lottery. We've just got to do better, which is why I'm so passionate about housing co-ops. I think that when governments understand that housing co-ops are can be well-regulated, well-governed organisations who deliver housing well, and we put people at the centre, we can. It becomes more than a chance, and it is a real option.
Well, that's fantastic. So we've talked a lot about the benefits and the finance. So just want to move on a little bit now to the sort of the performance and the governance at scale. When you say you have, 90 cooperative sort of entities with volunteer boards, so how do you keep that consistency and accountability across such a wide range?
So, as an organisation, Common Equity is a registered housing association. So that's what happened in Victoria. So, when the government decided to regulate community housing, they said, we're not going to regulate 100 housing co-ops. We're going to establish a company and then transfer title to that company to regulate the co-ops. As a registered housing association, the housing registrar holds us accountable for meeting 7 performance standards. And those performance standards include, for example, having to tenant all vacant properties within 21 days. We have to report our rental arrears level on an annual basis. We have to report our eviction level on an annual basis. We have to complete urgent repair qu requests within a specified period of time. We have to complete non-urgent repair requests in a different timeframe to urgent repair requests. And we are also monitored in how quickly we respond to tenant complaints. And that compliance, actually, you can have a look at the results came out last week. On the Victorian Housing Registrar's website, they publish for each community housing provider, including Common Equity, how they went against those compliance standards. Footnote, I'm pleased to report we got 6 green ticks on Friday, so I'm pleased about
Congratulations.
So that's how Common Equity is managed. So we're held to the same standards as any other community housing provider. Internally, how we manage our co-ops is we have those 90 co-ops, we have about 30 variables that we determine what's going to satisfy us that the individual co-op is a suitable entity for us to manage properties on our behalf. So we'll manage things like cash at bank. So we would expect every co-op to have at least $6,000 cash per property in bank to deal with responsive maintenance, whether or not they've held their AGM. whether or not they're so as an independent co-op, they're regulated by Consumer Affairs Victoria. We would want, are there any outstanding issues in relation to their regulation? We'd look at their rental arrears collection. How are they going with that? So we have all those variables that then we can assess any cooperative as, and we use a traffic light system, as red, green, or amber. That's then reported to the Common Equity Board. If a co-op is assessed as red alert, it will be all hands on deck to get that co-op back up to speed again.
Yes.
We'll have co-ops that'll move between green and amber, and that's okay, but we certainly, like at the moment, we don't have any co-ops on red alert, but that you've got to do that in a federated co-op model. You have to be proactively managing how that's happened.
Yeah, sure.
Just in relation to the board, one of the other key features of the common equity model we're particularly proud of is that we have a board of 11. As the managing director, I'm the 11th director. We do a you know, as part of good governance, we do a skills audit and a skills assessment. So we have five independent technical directors who deliver very specific skills to the board. Five of our board are elected by the co-op shareholders. So five co-op members sit on the board and bring that co-op voice, bring that lived experience to the management of the company. They are still required to be directors of the company, so they cannot, and we have a very strong chair who holds them accountable for not bringing issues in relation to their individual co-op to the board table. But it is a really important way of keeping the board focused on what matters. You know, we have consumers represent nearly 50% of the board, and that's one of the major criticisms of housing co-ops. They're volunteers. How can they be entrusted? Well, two of our directors have just completed the Australian Institute of Company Directors diploma, which is no mean feat. So we pair our co-op directors, our elected directors are paired with the technical directors in a structured mentoring relationship. So we have that way of, that's a part of the governance of our organisation. How do we honour and respect that lived experience?
And I think that, that's a very tangible reflection of the cooperative values, right? The education and training cooperative principle that
Absolutely.
underpins cooperatives around the world. You're demonstrating there in the federated model.
That education and training. We, as a board, we say that, you know, our job is to manage our organ strategically. Our statement of strategic intent is framed within the seven international co-op principles. So while we're governed by the Charities Commission and we're governed by the Australian Securities and Investment Corporation, we're also very much at heart, we're a co-op housing organisation.
Oh, that's super interesting. So, moving on now to some of the policy levers and just trying to get a handle on what could New Zealand copy, what can we replicate? So can you tell us about what particular Victorian state or Australian national policies made your growth possible? I mean, you have alluded to a couple, but yeah, could you sort of
I
talk
think
us
that yeah,
through?
the Victorian government really, Victoria is the largest provider by far of co-op housing in Australia, and that is because the government transferred title to the corporate entity. They didn't hold back and only offer a general lease. So we have a bankable balance sheet that we can leverage against to do our own independent development. That's a game changer, and certainly I support my Archer colleagues regularly in making that point to their individual state governments. What we're through the Australian Cooperative Housing Alliance, what we're actively seeking now is a dedicated stream of funding to grow co-op housing to 10% of the Australian community housing sector. It's currently just over 1%. In Victoria, it's 3%, and we're the large one of the largest providers of community housing in Victoria. But you need to get serious about how do we mainstream this idea? How do we make sure it's a bit like I was just at a meeting this morning talking about ESG. How do you ma mainstream this discussion so it's a serious part of our housing solution? So part of our private rental still has a place, home ownership still has a place, public housing still has a place, community housing still has a place. But when we look at alternatives to rental and we look at affordable permanent rental housing, that's where co-op housing fits in.
Yes.
And I think that's going to take a critical mass for it to be considered by property developers. So we're in discussion with property developers now doing, maybe 150, 200 unit developments. And I was able to bring back what I saw in Europe. So they're being encouraged to include affordable housing in these developments. And what we're saying is, as we will take two floors of that building and establish an elders co-op.
Right.
And so people live within a community within a high density environment
I see.
rather than the social isolation that often applies to older people living in a high density development.
That's a fantastic way to incorporate those different models together and offer everybody a slice of what it is that they really need at that time of their life.
Salt and pepper rather than vanilla.
I like it. Oh, that's fantastic. So if you were designing a New Zealand pilot for a federated housing co-op model, what kind of settings do you think would have to be in place? Like, what else would need to be true for this to be successful from a policy perspective?
I think you need to, and that's where I do a lot of my advocacy work. You need the policy advisors and the bureaucrats, including Treasury, to understand the model. And to understand it's not a kibbutz, it's not a commune,
Yeah.
commercially viable. It's a commercially viable housing model that makes commercial sense.
Yes.
And the fact that one of the things I really like about this model is the fact that once people get back on their feet and re-enter the housing market, they're not threatened with losing their housing once their income exceeds a particular level, which is often the case. So I think
Yeah.
you've got to have all of those, that level of understanding has to be important. We have recently had the Australian Cooperative Housing Summit in Melbourne. We had one in Adelaide next year. It's in Sydney in 2026. We're working with our Canadian colleagues to take a study tour group to Canada. So people get to understand this model has been operating for decades. It's an innovative housing solution, but it's not new. It's not risky.
Yeah, that I think that is one of the sticking points, the risk or perceived risk, and the education that needs to take place in order for there to be a true understanding
So the
of the
risk for
model.
co-op housing in Victoria is managed through regulatory oversight. So the housing registrar, as you know, I have to meet with the housing registrar once a quarter. I have very stringent reporting obligations to the housing registrar. The housing registrar addresses our AGM every year. So that regulatory oversight is really important. And that also gives the government assurance that these assets are being well managed. Community
Yes.
housing is precious. And so we do have to be prepared to be transparent and accountable about how we're managing it. Co-ops used to, in Australia at least, say, oh, we're our own best kept secret. Well, I can't sell a secret. So you need to shout it from the
Yes,
rooftop.
no, you're completely right. You're completely right. I mean, it would be, a fantastic outcome for New Zealand if we could get someone from our treasury on that study tour to Canada. That would be
Well,
an amazing opportunity.
I'll certainly encourage people. It's going to be an opportunity. I mean, Canada is doing this extraordinarily well and is
Right.
growing it and expanding it. So I can certainly share those details with you, and we would
Yeah.
welcome our colleagues from across the Tasman to join us in learning more about the possible.
Yes.
And I think that's I mean, I know our time's running out, but one of the things that really disappointed me in the Australian federal election this year was there was nothing on the table other than home ownership.
I see. Right.
And And that's because we need to help governments get comfortable with talking about another option. So there's a 5% deposit scheme. So, you can buy a house with a 5% deposit, but when the average cost of a house in Australia is close to, $650,000, you've still got a heck of a debt. And
You
how are you
don't.
going to service that and maintain it and insure it and stay sane and live while you pay your mortgage? There's an alternative beyond that that we saw in Vienna, in Switzerland, in Denmark, in Ireland, in the UK, in Canada. We need to look externally to countries where home ownership hasn't been an option since the war.
Yep, no, I love the sound of that, Liz.
Good,
And I
no.
will definitely take you up on that offer to follow that up, to get somebody on
I'll be
that.
working on that early in the new year, and it's probably going to be in June, July. So I'll
Okay.
share the details so you can promote it.
Fantastic. So I'd just like to close out with something really amazingly positive. So can you tell us a short story, something that really has stuck with you about the difference that a co-op home has made to a tenant?
To a group of tenants, it's family violence victim survivors. So before
Right.
I came to work with Common Equity, I worked with a frontline family violence response service. And so it's an area that remains close to my heart. And one of our co-op members who passed away last year at 92 talked to me about, she was very passionate, very actively involved in our kind of across co-op community. And she said to me one day, "I know the difference this made to my life." And she said, "I went to co-op meetings every month and I didn't speak for 2.5 years at a co-op meeting." And she said, because of what she'd been through, she said, "I'd actually lost my power of speech in a group situation. That's how low my self-esteem was." And she said, "But I sat at those meetings and grad," she said, "my kids, my four kids, they were safe. I was safe. We were housed. And I went along to each one of those co-op meetings out of a sense of obligation for what I'd received." And she said, "And then one day I spoke." And Gail went on to chair her co-op, to be a really active member of our co-op, feisty member of our co-op community. But she always, as I said, she left us last year, but she's always just, she was so honest about her own experience, but also her desire to ensure other women had that. And we know that with family violence victim survivors, co-op housing is particularly successful because it's not a formal wraparound support service. We aren't paid to deliver that wraparound support service. The community wraps its arms around its own community members and provides that support organically.
Yeah,
So that's a
that
lovely
is the
tribute to Gail. Thank you for the opportunity.
yeah, that's a fantastic way to conclude today. So thank you again, Liz. Look, you've really painted a picture of a mature system that lets co-ops thrive alongside other types of housing options. And it really strikes me that the levers aren't mystical at all. They're definitely policy choices that we could make here in New Zealand. So if there are any listeners in New Zealand policy, banking and housing, perhaps the question isn't, can we do this, but why haven't we yet? So I'll be writing about that soon. So stay tuned. And thank you very much for listening in to Co-op Leader Conversations.